Mr. Whipple, please don't squeeze the Charmin. Reach out and touch someone. And touching is believing. These advertising slogans suggest the importance of haptics, or the science of touch, in business. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
When we look for a cantaloupe at the grocery store, or shop for a sweater at a department store, how do we use our sense of touch? How does the sense of touch differ from other senses? If a sales clerk touches us, are we more or less likely to buy something? What does our inability to touch anything if we shop online do to us as consumers? Joining us to discuss Does Touch Matter is Joanne Peck, a professor of marketing and the associate dean of the undergraduate business program in the UW-Madison School of Business.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
This is a topic I wouldn't have touched with a 10-foot pole until now, and now it suddenly sounds fascinating. We do have all these sort of notions of touch that are ingrained in the language, don't we?
Yes, we do. In fact, it's really interesting when you read some of the history of touch, because touch was considered the most prominent sense. If you think about Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel, God is actually breathing life into Adam by the sense of touch, with the two fingers just about touching. And if you look historically, the historical prominence of touch is also reflected in a lot of language that we use. So, for example, the sense of affect, how are you feeling? So the word feeling is a touch word. Or cognition, can you handle the problem? Or can you grasp the situation?
Or you're a soft touch.
Yeah, right. Personality, it's someone who's got an abrasive personality. They rub you the wrong way. They're a touchy person. Or, as you had mentioned, communication. So on the other hand, keep in touch. Or Apple's slogan is touching is believing.
It's too touchy-feely for me.
Yeah. Why do you think touch was considered the most prominent to begin with?
You know, I think Aristotle also thought that thousands of particles bombarded our bodies and every other sense was mediated by these particles. And I think it fell out of favor because a lot of the original experiments were set up as which is better, touch or vision. Well, the way these were set up were very biased towards vision. So they were usually shape and size determinants, and touch is terrible at shape and size. So I think that's one reason that it's for a long time fell out of favor.
On the other hand, let's see, I think it would be very rare for anybody to lose their sense of touch.
Yes.
Because you can lose your sight, you can lose your hearing, you can even lose your sense of taste and smell.
Right.
But touch.
Yeah, so it's something you would think, right, that would be really important for everybody.
Well, and so dangerous if you lose it, like if you can't feel heat.
Yes.
You know, or cold.
Or pain.
Yeah.
Or contact.
Right. The contact, too, is really important. In fact, a lot of this, so I was involved with this internet study, and people would call me and say, I would never buy online because I can't touch. I would never buy through catalog because I can't touch. And that's when I started thinking about, does touch really matter and how does it matter? And I think the growth of non-touch media, like internet shopping, has made it more prominent than it has in the past.
Of course, if it's a touch screen, that helps.
Yeah, I think there is something, you know, if you look at a lot of the devices we use now, there is this positive sensory feeling of touch. You may not get information, but there's still that feeling of touch, which can matter a lot.
Well, that's one of the criticisms of Kindles and Nooks by people who are, you know, real bibliophiles,
yes,
is that it doesn't have the texture, it doesn't have the feel and the snap of the binding and all of that.
Right.
They so have these pleasant associations with a new book.
You know, actually, that's really interesting, because when I started thinking about why would someone want to touch a product, there are four things that touch is really good at. So one is texture, temperature, weight, and hardness or softness. And if a category, product category, doesn't vary in a diagnostic way on one of those, then touch is less important. So one example I would always use are books, because they don't vary in a diagnostic way on any of those. But to people that are avid readers, they would tell me exactly what you just said, that even they would never buy a book without touching because the pages can feel completely different depending on which version of a book you get. So that led me to some research that where we looked at if you're an expert in a category, almost no matter what the category, touch is more important to you than if you're not really an expert. So there are product category differences. So people in general would want to touch clothing that varies on texture and weight as compared to something like a book or software or something that doesn't vary in a diagnostic way on one of those four
items. Or aspirin.
Right, or aspirin, exactly.
Yeah. I'm thinking about infants, too, and how easy it is to soothe an infant if you have a soft blanket, you know, something cuddly. We all are familiar with all the wonderful stuffed animals and soft, fuzzy blanket kind of things. So it must be just an innate need we have for something cuddly.
Yes, and actually, what's interesting about that is when I started all this, I thought the main reason consumers touch is for product information. And what I've found is my research has evolved from more product information to more that sensory feeling. So there are a lot of people that just enjoy the textures. And you're right, children, that's one of the first things they do with touch is they stroke a blanket. So they use lateral motion is this stereotypical hand movement that's associated with texture. So you can see people stroking things. And also when you think about older people, they say pets are really important because just that stroking calms people down. So I do think there's a lot more to touch than just the product attributes, but that's how I first started researching a lot of this.
Did you run into any, or do you run into people who, when you say, well, I study touch, who look at you like you're sort of a flaky new age type?
All the time.
Yeah. How do you, let's say you're sitting on an airplane explaining what you do to someone who thinks it's a little far out. How would you answer the question of, you know, well, why does it matter?
Why does it matter? So one thing I will ask them, is there anything that you refuse to buy online? So sometimes what I've found is there is this individual difference in preference for touch. Some people just enjoy it more. They miss it more. These are the people that rip open packaging in the store. They're high, I call it need for touch. So there's a scale to measure this individual difference. Whereas other people, it's not as important to them. So there is a huge individual difference in how much people really prefer touch. So one of the first times I got into a store to actually look at people shopping, the manager let me watch people, but he wouldn't let me talk to them. Eventually, I got past that. But one of the things I noticed is that I looked at people in the produce section. I timed how long they were in there. I looked at which items they touched and what they ultimately purchased. But one thing that I noticed is there were some people that no matter what the category, they did minimal touch, which I call touch to purchase. So the only reason they touch it is to put it in the cart. And if you think about online shopping, that's a click. So that you can compensate for. Where there are other people, no matter what the category, would spend a long time exploring. You know, and sometimes it was diagnostic. So like peaches or nectarines, how hard are they?
Right.
To see how ripe they are. You know, whereas other times it didn't seem to be very diagnostic. So for example, banana, you know, they may lift it up, touch it, only to rotate it to see if how black it is.
Right.
So it's not really something touch is great at, but they just touch to get other information, whereas there were the people that were touching to figure out more diagnostic information. So there's a huge variety of how people use touch.
But the packaging discourages touch more and more, it seems to me, when you get into the blister packs and that kind of thing. I mean, even once you've bought it, you can hardly touch it without, you know, a hacksaw to get to it. And then that's even true of some produce, though.
Yes, that's true. And it's interesting that the cultural differences, too. So people come from England and they say it drives them crazy because they can't touch sheets in the U.S., whereas in England, they're used to touching. Here we use thread count as a surrogate.
Right.
So you can use other information to compensate for some touch information. So, for example, weight, if it's described pretty accurately, that's usually pretty good compensation. But in some cases, like texture or softness, it's very difficult to compensate people for inability to touch. And then your example of the packaging, there's this visual preview model where we visually glance, and that directs our touch or haptic processing. So haptic is touching with the hands, and it comes from the Greek word haptikos. So whenever I say that, it just means touching with the hands. But this visual preview model, you visually glance, and that directs further haptic processing. So for these low need for touch people, online, if you think about, you can magnify texture that visual, that's enough for them. That compensates them. Whereas the high need for touch people, that frustrates them. So it's like even more they want to touch when they don't have that ability. So I've done studies where these high need for touch people, they're more frustrated, they're less confident, they don't pay as much. All these effects happen when they can't touch.
And something kind of magical can happen, can't it, when you get to touch the
yes.
product? You have this sense of ownership.
Yes. Okay, so what's really interesting, there's one study where I actually could talk to people in a grocery store. And what I was looking at was touch and unplanned or impulse purchasing. And they let me change the signs above the peaches and nectarines to either no sign or just regular store signage. And then I had one that said, feel the freshness. So that was the touch one. And then one, see the freshness, just to make sure it wasn't an additional sign that was having this effect. So what I would do is I would alternate the signs and I kind of hide behind the nutrition signs so that people didn't see. And what I would do is watch a shopper come in, record all the hand movements, what they ultimately purchase, peaches or nectarines. And then my original plan was to have them fill out like a 2-page survey in the store, which, as you can imagine, nobody grocery shopping wants to stop and fill out a 2-page
Once
survey.
Once you picked up the ice cream, you don't want to do that.
Right. You know, I mean, in retrospect, it was I probably should have seen that. But what I did is I altered the study so that I thought, what do I really need in the store? What I really need is, did they notice a sign up there? And what was their level of impulse purchase? And then I asked if I could mail them a questionnaire, a 2-page questionnaire, and then entered them in a drawing for $100 worth of groceries to the store. So I got over 80% of the people that actually complied with that. And one of the things that's probably not surprising is about a third of the people noticed the sign was even up there. Because of all the clutter in a grocery store, a lot of people didn't notice.
Well, you get tunnel vision, too. I mean, if you've been in that store many times, I mean, it's to a fault. You don't see anything except what you are looking for.
Exactly what you're looking at. So what I had to do is analyze separately people that noticed the sign versus didn't. And one super interesting finding is these high need for touch people, more of them notice the feel sign. So they notice touch information in the environment, whereas the see the freshness, there was no difference between these high and low need for touch. But for everybody, having a sign encouraging touch increased unplanned purchasing. So that was one main effect. So if you put a sign encouraging touch, and I think this gets to the ownership that you just brought up, I think that increases unplanned purchase. The other interesting finding is, in general, high need for touch people purchase more impulsively overall than lower need for touch people. So the sign helped both, but overall, these high people, they make more unplanned purchase than low.
So I'm thinking about Mr. Whipple and the Charmin.
Yes.
So I gather then that that's a calculated, you know, strategy on the part of Charmin to use our sense of touch.
Yes, because if you think about softness is something a lot of people would feel, because he used to say, feel the softness. So if you think about that, you know, a lot of people would want that just for diagnostic information, because it's people would say that matters for that category. But then there's the additional effect of, if you grab it, you actually start to feel this ownership. So I did a follow-up study where I measured people's psychological feeling of ownership after touch and not touching. Because in economics, there's the endowment effect, where people value objects they own. It's a really robust finding. So then I thought, well, there's also psychological ownership, where you legally don't own it, but you feel ownership towards it.
Because you've had your hands on it?
Yes. So I found that if touch compared to not touch, just a minimal touch makes people feel more ownership, and ownership always leads to increased valuation. So if you touch it, you're going to value it more and you're going to pay more for it. So if you're a manufacturer, if you can get people to touch, people will be more likely to buy it and they will pay more for it.
Is some of that the way, you know, if we touch a food item, we have this feeling, well, you don't want somebody else then to have get our germs or something.
Yes.
Is any of it that?
Yeah, okay.
Social consciousness?
No, actually, there's some research that's really interesting. Andrea Morales, who has done work on contagion. So everybody wants a fresh one. So
well, yeah.
So
used bookstores notwithstanding.
Exactly. Right. I talked to people at Procter & Gamble, and they had some little strips where you could scratch and sniff on the packaging of toothpaste so people could see, could smell what it would taste like. And they found that people would do that and they'd all take a fresh one. So that's one of those issues that there is some evidence that people want to touch it, but they don't want something that everybody else has already touched.
Like the peach, if exactly. 100 people have picked up the same peach.
But of course, you don't really know about the peach, but the scratch and sniff thing. But you're
yes.
not saying that if they pick one up that's fresh and they scratch and sniff it, they'll grab another one?
Yes, that's exactly what they do. Yes.
They won't pick up the one that they personally have?
No, they take a fresh one. So then what P&G did was they had things at the shelf that were not on the packaging so that, because otherwise there's a lot of wasted packaging.
Well, sure. Mm-hmm.
Right, so people want one, but they don't want everyone else's touched unless it's an attractive person. So there's another study where they had this attractive person try on a T-shirt, and they made it either that she had just tried it on or not. And they found that if people were more willing to want to buy it if they thought an attractive person had been associated with it than not. So contagion can work both ways,
I
guess.
Is there a gender jump thing going on there?
You know, you would think there would be, but they didn't find it in that study. That
no
wasn't
kidding.
My study. But, yeah, you would think there would be. That
so,
seems
I mean,
like
a guy is just as likely to buy a T-shirt if a handsome guy has been wearing it as if a
well,
an attractive
that does sound,
woman has been wearing
well,
it.
Well, the only one, they only had a woman trying it on.
Uh-huh.
Any gender differences with the in general with sense of touch and peaches and
sure.
all the rest of it?
Okay, so there's when you talk about this individual difference in touch, there's the touch for information. So I call it instrumental touch, where you're trying to figure out attribute information to decide whether to buy. But then there's this autotelic touch, so just touch for the fun sensory feeling. And talking to, for example, Marshall Fields, it's now Macy's, used to be Marshall Fields, the manager said the women's oval room is set aside, expensive clothing, because so many people walk through and just feel it for fun that the oil on their hands spoils
sure,
the clothing.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I found in general with the instrumental touch, though the product attribute touch, there's no gender difference, but the autotelic, the nice feeling, women are just slightly higher than men on that. So there is a little bit of a difference, but it's not enough to really matter in most of the studies that I've done.
There's certain fabrics that just come to mind, like velvet or
yes.
satin or different things.
Right.
Where, what is it that happens in our brain when we touch something like that?
Yeah, you know, that's not really my area of expertise, so I really can't answer that.
Well, we will find out what the effects are when store personnel touch potential customers. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Joanne Pack, and we are talking about why are we so touchy, how the sense of touch plays a role, especially in marketing and business. So what kinds of differences do you find in our experience with online shopping versus in-the-store shopping?
Okay, sure. As I had mentioned, so haptics, the sense of touch, is really good at four specific attributes. And there are two cognitive psychologists, Lederman and Klatsky, who have done a lot of work on this. What's amazing about the haptic perceptual system is you can watch people's hand movements and figure out what information they're ascertaining. So, for example, touch is really good at texture. So you can see it's called lateral motion, but you can see somebody rubbing fabric or something back and forth. So think about clothing when you buy those. So there are certain types of products that you would want to feature more online and other ones at the retail. So texture is one. Hardness, it has this accompanying exploratory procedure or hand movement called pressure. You can see people pushing in. So if you think about the keys of a cell phone or something like that, touch is better than any other sense at that. Then there's weight and unsupported holding. Think of hefting an object. That's the exploratory procedure associated with weight. So a lot of sporting equipment, or if you think about like flatware, the heft can kind of give you information. Some electronics manufacturers will put weights in because weight or heftiness is associated with quality. You don't want it too light.
They'll actually put extra weight in it.
Right, just so because the heft is associated with quality. And then temperature. So static contact, where you lay your hand on something, that's associated with temperature. That's the exploratory procedure. So if you think about soda, or there was a study done by Anheuser-Busch, people buying beer, and over 90% of beer is bought cold. And you can see people on the cooler using static contact to figure out which is the coolest, over brand.
Can I drink it now?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the products that most vary on one of these qualities would be better featured in a retail store, whereas ones that aren't as critical or not diagnostic, those would be better featured online. It's kind of a long way of answering your question.
I'm trying to think of, you said earlier, Joanne, that if you can get the potential buyer to touch the product, that there's this bonding that goes on, this sense of ownership. I'm trying to think if there's an example of merchandise where you actually get to use the product.
Yes. Well, I think about test drives or try it free for a week. Any kind of product trial. Mm. And if you think about longer lengths of touch reflect more feelings of ownership. If you really don't want to buy a product, I would say that's pretty dangerous. Any kind of trial period, because the longer you interact with it, the more you're going to feel like it's yours and the more you're going to be willing to pay for it. So I think product trial is very effective because of this ownership feeling.
And some of those trials, you actually have to, go out on a limb a little bit. In other words, if you're trying out a mattress, you actually have to lie down in the store, which can be a little awkward for some people. But if you get them to bridge that gap, then you've got the edge.
Yes, I think so. And I think it's used pretty effectively in a lot of stores. So when I did that one in the store with changing the signs, the manager said, well, then should I have people touch everything? And I just said, well, I think if you had signs all over feel this, feel that, it would be a little too much. But at least preliminary results look like it can be a really effective technique.
Well, I would think being able to touch something, if I think back to, like, say, a children's museum, where they will often have a touching area where you can stroke the animal fur, and you can pick up this jaw, and you can do something. It's such a break from all the don't touch, because we also get so many messages in our culture, wouldn't you say, that say don't touch.
Oh, yes. And I think it's almost the freedom to touch. If you think about, I thought maybe this need for touch, there'd be an age difference. Because if you think about children, a lot of why they touch is exploratory, to get information. And like all senses, the sense of touch dulls as we age. So braille dots are farther apart for older consumers or older people. But in all my studies, I haven't seen a very significant difference in age. Probably for what I'm studying, it's not as important. But I think you're right. It's almost the freedom to touch. And it's funny that you mentioned the Children's Museum, because I actually did a study with Jennifer Wiggins, who was a PhD student, with the Madison Children's Museum. So one of the things that I kept hearing about as I was doing this product-related research is these touch attributes that were persuasive, even though they didn't have any product attributes. So, for example, there was this student of mine from India, and he bought in this. It was for a charity, and it was soliciting donations, but the front of it had a piece of sandpaper, and it said, feel this, and then you open it up, and it says, to feel 9-year-old Malesha's hand. And it talked about his hard life. So here's a touch where, yes, it's related, but it's not a product attribute. And it was one of the most successful charitable donations they've ever had.
Interesting.
Right. So then we decided, being an experimentalist, let's just try that. Let's set up an experiment and see if we can put a touch element on a pamphlet. Does it matter? So we designed one, Get in Touch with Nature, for the UW Arboretum. And we had these different touch elements on the front. So we thought of two things. One is, does the touch element fit with the message? So get in touch with nature. And then the other one is, how does the touch element feel? So does it feel negatively, neutral, or very positively? So we varied all these. And then our main dependent measures were giving time or money to the Arboretum. And what we found out is, first of all, if you think about what we found for fit, sandpaper, people said, yes, that fits, and it feels pretty, like, neutral. And then we had tree bark, and then we had a feather. So we had those three things. What we found for not fit, we had steel wool. So that was the one that felt terrible and didn't fit. For these high need for touch people, any touch element was persuasive compared to no touch element. So you could put steel wool on, get back in touch with nature.
Really?
And that was persuasive, which we were surprised at. I mean, I know touch is important, but really. The other thing that we found is for the lower need for touch, fit matters. So there has to be this perceived fit between the touch element and the message. So then we did a follow-up with, so that study was with undergraduates at the business school. We did a follow-up with the Madison Children's Museum for external validity reasons, and they were doing a pamphlet soliciting new memberships. And what we did is they have a dinosaur on the front, and there was one circle on the dinosaur they let us put a fuzzy dot on. And we mailed those out, and we found the ones with the fuzzy dot, there were significantly more people that were joining the Madison Children's Museum.
Wow.
Because since it is a hands-on museum, this idea of the touch actually fit with the museum. Because we were concerned, we did not want to decrease their membership with anything that we were doing. So we made sure it felt good and it fit. So in general, if it feels neutral or positive, it's more persuasive. And if it fits, it's more persuasive.
Do we have any sense of how many people are touched?
High and low?
Yeah.
So when we do this research, generally what we do is a median split, so it's half and half. We just take it right down the middle. We add up these 12 items and do half and half. It's a normal type distribution. So there are some really high and some really low. Most people are kind of in the middle. But a lot of people will say, oh, yes, you know, like I would not buy something if I couldn't touch it. And talking to Land's End, who they probably have one of the highest sales of clothing online, they had told me that a lot of those shoppers were catalog shoppers switching to online. And they're like, if only we could get all those other people that need to touch.
So they can get, they can get the low-touch people to switch over to catalog or online.
Right.
But the high-touch, they have to figure out how to convert them over. Well, I can see now why politicians shake hands all the time.
Oh, yes. I think we're going to talk about interpersonal touch in a little bit. But I do think that's really significant. It matters a lot.
I'm assuming that there's a lot of need for touch if you're buying something like a sweater, for instance. So knowing what they know about sense of touch from research you and other people have done on it, let's say you're running a department store.
Yes.
And you want people to buy expensive sweaters when they walk into the door of Macy's.
Right.
Are there ways that you can sort of highlight, you know, and make it easy for people to touch things like that?
Yeah, so I think one is packaging. So in sweaters, it's not usually an issue because you usually have one out so that people can actually touch. Towels are interesting, or sheets, or like for women, pantyhose, they're putting more samples out so people don't rip open the packaging. Bedding is a really good example. So they have the zipper compartments where you can unzip and feel the material a little bit. So anything that makes it easier for a consumer to feel is helpful, although we do have that contagion aspect of it. So having a sample out there that everybody can sample is a pretty effective way to do it. And just letting people or encouraging them to touch is very effective. And if they see other people touching, often that encourages people to want to touch it more.
Do we have a sense of once they try it on, does the chance that they'll buy it really ramp up?
You know, I've just looked at mere touch, increasing this feeling of ownership. So one of the studies, one of the things that we have to be careful of is when we're writing up these research papers is any possible criticism in the method of what we do. So when we were looking at, does touch really lead to more ownership? We had to be really careful in the product that we picked because somebody could say, well, of course, if you touch it, you get more information. And if you get more information, then you're going to value it more. So we purposely had to pick a product where you would not get information from touching. So we used a Slinky. Because if you think about, you know, most people have touched a Slinky.
I get a lot of information. It's like, can I make it work or not?
Okay, so you get the fun information. Well, we started with that because we thought, okay, is there attribute information that you're actually getting from a Slinky And we ask people, have you played with a Slinky before? And pretty much everybody has. But we purposely picked products where there wasn't. So you asked about, like, the toilet paper, Charmin. If you think about that, you get the instrumental product attribute softness, but then you also get the secondary effect of just mere touch leads to ownership. So the other thing we thought is, okay, let's see if we can reverse this effect. What if you touch something and it feels bad? Then can we decrease people's willingness to pay for it? So most things in the marketplace do not feel bad. They feel either neutral or positive.
Tell me this isn't going to be sandpaper and toilet paper.
Sort of similar. We found a child's play material that when you first touch it, it feels not great. It feels really sticky. So we actually had to limit people's touch of that because the longer they touch it, the more they like it. But just for their affective reaction, we found that they thought it was negative. But we still got the positive ownership feeling, and we did not get willingness to pay to decrease. We got it to not increase as much when it felt bad, but we never got it to decrease. So we just did that just to test really our model to see what if it did feel bad.
This is a little off topic, but I've noticed at recent faculty meetings that I've been at in one of my departments that they'll bring a bowl of squishy toys that we're supposed to. I think they're meant to decrease stress, but everybody.
You're supposed to squeeze it?
Yes. So we have all these professors squeezing, you know, things. And I would love a study of, you know, are you more likely to vote for the thing that your chairman wants you to vote for if you're squeezing a squishy toy?
I like that idea.
You know, kind of placated that way. I think, you know, touch does have a soothing
calm
effect.
Yes.
Are there other areas besides stores where, you know, giving you something to touch
would calm
you
down?
The way people would sometimes have like a rabbit fur. Or,
right.
You know, are there other instances that you can think of where
that's
where
really
we rely on touch for
just to calm us down? Well, I think part of the nursing home examples with pets is one example where it just calms people down a little bit. And so, I think of all the things that touch is great at, texture or this lateral motion exploratory procedure is the one that's associated with lower stress, calming, and I also think softness. Softness is different than anything else. It's very difficult to compensate for softness. So if you try to describe softness to people, these high need for touch people, it doesn't really work. You know, whereas weight you can describe in words. So if you think about how do you compensate for an inability to touch, some attributes you can, and some is really difficult to compensate for.
Well, I mean, you're talking about, even if you're talking about the Charmin, it's wrapped up.
Yes. You still feel the plastic.
Yeah. How can you tell how soft it really is other than it's squishy, but you can't really get the texture from
that? No, you're right. So one of the things, you know, you can think of probably somebody who you think might be high need for touch, but they buy some product online. Well, why do they do that? One of the things people do is they go to stores and they find what they want. They go online to buy it cheaper. So that's a compensation mechanism, lower price. Or they buy a brand they already know and they trust. It's a repeat purchase. So they already have one at home, so they know. So the first time you buy something, it might be more exploratory. After that, it's easier to compensate people.
So if I have this, grocery store, let's say, where do I go with this information?
So I would say what you really want to do in a grocery store, if you can highlight items, like the field of freshness. So I'll tell you what was sort of a funny story. When I started to set that study up, what I really wanted to do is get a product category that people wanted to touch for diagnostic reasons, like peaches and nectarines, which is what I used. But what I really wanted to do was a middle category, like bread in plastic, and then a low category, like cereal. Because I thought I could get a fraction. And the manager, as you can imagine, said, I would alienate my consumers if I said, touch the cereal. And I understand that now, but I think in the follow-up research I've done, I could be pretty convincing that you could reward it in a different way. But I think encouraging people to interact. So maybe put it in a position where it encourages people. So, for example, the end of aisle displays are known. People, they pay more attention. They run into them. For a package designer, any interesting graphics on a package, anything that makes people want to pick up that package can be really effective. So I think there's some package designers that are starting to put more texture in, But I think that's really an underutilized way that could be very effective.
Seems to me there's a dark side to that, too, though, from a sales standpoint. And the two examples that come to mind, one of them is bologna or lunch meat. You pick up the package. You realize, the first thing that happens is your finger curls around the back. You realize that most of it's not there. You know,
it's
all bumped out.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I guess that's always a danger, right?
And the same kind of similarly with cereal, there are certain kinds, especially the sort of, I wouldn't say organic necessarily, but some of them are specialized cereals.
Yeah.
Okay, it's in a box about the same size as other cereal, but it's more expensive, and you pick it up and you realize immediately there's nothing in the top half of the box.
Yes, and I think you could say, well, if you don't realize it in the store, you're going to realize it when you get home, right? So it's sort of like...
Do they need to add weights to the cereal boxes?
Yeah, no, we might be getting into some ethical issues.
Some styrofoam peanuts to fill up the top.
Exactly,
half of the
box, so it doesn't shake quite as much.
We're going to look at the science of touching each other when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Joanne Peck, who is telling us about the effects of touch, particularly as it pertains so far to retail sales and how we respond to things that we can touch. And we've talked about this, or we've mentioned this a couple times already, so we'd best get to this whole phenomenon, Joanne, of the effectiveness in a retail situation of people touching the customer.
Yeah, it's a very interesting area. There have been a few studies in marketing where they have very positive effects of salespeople or wait people touching a customer. So there's this one study by Hornick who, what he did is he had a wait person unobtrusively touch a diner on the upper arm and said, "Is everything okay?" And they found that people touched versus not touched left bigger tips, and they were more satisfied with the restaurant. There's another study where they had a librarian return a library card, and she either touched the person or not. People that were touched thought she was smiling more, even though she was never smiling, and were more satisfied with the library.
Wow.
So conventional research has said it's great. Touch is great in a retail environment. But then I've talked to a lot of people that have told me things like, well, yes, you know, if someone touches me, I'll buy something just so I can escape and never go back.
Well, the most extreme experience I personally had with this was in China. It was at a place called the fake store in Beijing, where all kinds of knockoffs, you know, pseudo Guccis and things like that you can get. And it was just stall after stall in this big sort of warehouse-like place. And I was kind of very lightly passing over some merchandise. They were Gucci wallets, quote, Gucci wallets, in fact. And this young lady, clerk, came around and literally grabbed me by the lapels and started almost like dancing, telling me about, in her best English, the virtues of these wallets. And I got to admit, I did buy two of them.
So it was a fact. Now, did you buy it out of fear?
Sheer entertainment value.
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, also, but you're right. That to some extent, just let me out of here. Okay, I'll buy it.
You right. Know. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, too, because there's big cultural differences or norms as far as comfort with interpersonal touch. So in U.S. in general, we're a relatively low-touch culture, and it's been linked to the closer you are to the equator, the higher touch you are, which is sort of interesting.
You
because
it'll be the other way around.
Right, you know, that's,
yeah,
but
you
I think there's...
you need warmth, but maybe we're just used to holding up in our houses. And
being covered.
Well, I think there's less to touch when you're farther from the equator because there's so many barriers with all the clothing that you wear, whereas near the equator, there's actually more to touch. So there are cultural differences, and I've a PhD student, Andrea Webb, and I have been working on this comfort with interpersonal touch because we think even across societies, within one, there are some people that are more comfortable than others within every type of culture.
Sure.
So that's one of the things we're looking at. So I can give you some examples. Culture matters a lot. Status matters a lot. Mm-hmm. So a higher status can touch a person of lower status usually. They say it's like using someone's first name, but not the reverse.
Remember that when Queen Elizabeth was, where was it, in the Bahamas?
Yeah.
And she was going through some kind of a service area. I think it was a food service area of some kind. And one of the Bahamian women embraced her, and it was like the world almost stopped turning for a second there.
Yes, you don't do that, right? Right. She's high status. She can touch you, but you can't touch her. So status usually matters across culture. Some of the other things that matter are gender. So in general, male-to-male touch is the most variable across cultures. And in the U.S., it's usually more uncomfortable than some other cultures. And one of the reasons for that that's been talked about, and this is research that others have done, is because male-to-male status matters more with males than females in general. So a male-to-male touch could be inferred as some sort of status, and that might upset someone. And also the homophobic part
right,
of it,
exactly.
Male-to-male. So those two make male-to-males where you get the most differences across every kind of gender dyad. So that's just something that we have to consider. Relationship's another one. So if it's a friend or family member, is different than a stranger.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So what we're usually looking at is a stranger, like a salesperson touch in the store.
So if I'm looking at used cars and the salesman comes up and like touches me on the shoulder,
yes,
he's probably going to write off that particular sale. That's not likely to happen.
Yeah, so I think, so we have some preliminary evidence. If you're really comfortable with initiating and receiving touch, so there's the two dimensions, it actually might be a positive for you. So for some people, it's a bonding. It feels good. And it does depend on these lots of factors as well as your comfort in general. So it could still be a positive for some males if you're really comfortable with it.
But how would a salesperson know that? Let's say you
right.
walk into a car lot and the
yes.
person selling the car really wants to make that sale and knows that some people patting them on the shoulder is going to be a help.
Yes.
Other people it's going to turn them away.
I think you have to be cautious, especially male to male. So I would say if you're the salesperson, if they seem to initiate touch, because if people that are really comfortable might initiate it when you're talking to them, then it's okay. But if they don't, especially male to male, I would be very careful.
But male to female, too, it can seem like harassment pretty quickly.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think male salespeople in general have to be more cautious of the touch than female salespeople. Because female to female and female to male is usually more positive, even if you're not as comfortable with interpersonal touch.
So if that female is wearing a T-shirt that she wants to sell me and she touches me, it's probably a done deal.
Yeah, probably. Depending on how comfortable you are.
She's trying to dance with you. Like,
yeah, then you might be. Well, and this brings up, too, the type of touch matters, too. So if you think about handshakes, there are certain norms for certain situations. So when you're in a job interview, you will shake hands. So that matters. What we are usually doing is touch, unobtrusive touch or light, non-sexual touch on the upper arm, because the previous studies in marketing have used that same type of touch. So when we're doing touch, that's usually what we're talking about.
Shoulder, elbow.
Yep. Usually from the shoulder down to the elbow, somewhere on the upper arm is usually what we're talking about.
What did you find? I know that at one point you studied roller derby people. Tell us about that.
So Andrea Webb, she's the PhD student, and I were developing this comfort with interpersonal touch scale. And part of the scale development is to get a lot of items, generate a lot of items that measure both the initiating and the receiving dimensions. And then it's called known group validity. You find a group where you think it's going to be either very high or very low on your scale and test it. So if you've ever seen roller derby, it seems like a group of women that are pretty comfortable with touch, initiating and receiving, because it's a pretty high contact sport. So what they let us do is come in, and it was pretty incredible to see these women skate, by the way, if you ever have free time. Very great athletes. So they let us come in and administer our scale. And compared to female undergrads, women in roller derby are significantly higher in their comfort with both initiating touch and receiving touch.
So regardless of gender.
Yeah, well, we just use women just because that's who's doing roller derby in Madison.
I mean, and how did you test it?
So we give them the scale items, and we look at the mean of the scale items.
But
so
what do you mean by scale items? Oh, what is it they actually did?
Okay, so what they did is they filled out a questionnaire. So some of the items are, I'm more touchy than most of my friends, or I'm very comfortable when a stranger puts their arm on me, that kind of thing. So there was a bunch of different sentences where they had to respond to about how comfortable they were with both initiating and receiving. And they were more comfortable than regular undergrad students. And we compared them just to the female because they were just female roller derby players. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's what we thought would happen. It's part of the whole skill development. And then we also looked at, so this comfort with interpersonal touch and the need for touch I'd mentioned earlier with the product touch. So that individual difference. And so those are related. They're correlated about 0.4. So there's some positive correlation. If you are comfortable touching products, you're somewhat comfortable touching people, but not really high. It's definitely a distinct type construct. So with the scale development, we tried that known group validity. And the thing that we really wanted to do is, our initial anecdotal evidence is that touch can be bad for some people in a store. We really wanted to go in a store and test this. So we were fortunate enough to have a colleague working in Sweden who said he had a sports store and they would love to do a study with us in the store. So it was quite an involved affair.
That's very far from the equator, you know.
Yeah, they're actually similar to where we are as far as touch. In fact, I went and gave this talk in Europe a few different places, and one in Norway, they said that's the reason they drink so much, so they can touch.
break those walls.
Exactly. So I think similar to the U.S. culture, they're relatively low in their comfort with touch. So we went to one of their sports stores, which is a chain, the biggest chain in Sweden. And they let us have two confederates, which are helpers. They're dressed as salespeople, but they're really helping with our study. We had a male and female because we wanted to make sure that we looked at the gender differences. They wore the attire of the store, like employees. And we had shoppers come in, and we just asked them if they would help us with a study. And what we did is give them a sheet of paper, and it was color-coded to be either in the touch or the no-touch condition. So our Confederate salesperson could see what condition they are as the person kind of came through the aisle. And then in the touch condition, they would just touch them lightly on the upper arm saying, may I help you? In the no-touch condition, they would just go up and say, may I help you? And then so the person would either say yes or no, and then they would... The shopper eventually would check out, and then they would come back to our table. And what we did was we had an iPad that we would take a picture of the receipt so we could look at the number of items purchased, how much total they purchased. We had them fill out the survey with their comfort with interpersonal touch scale, among other items. And then that we thanked them and kind of debriefed them. So it's kind of – we're preliminarily at the beginning of looking at this data. But it looks like what we thought would probably happen is happening. If your comfort level is high, then a salesperson touching you is very positive. They stayed with the salespeople longer. They ended up purchasing more. We also controlled for attractiveness of the salespeople.
I was going to say, yes.
Yeah. So Tobias was our guy who everybody found extremely attractive. So the women would disappear with Tobias, you know, for kind of a long time. So we were a little concerned about that.
Those Swedes.
Yeah.
And that was regardless of whether he touched them or not? Or
yeah, pretty much. But it seemed to be more pronounced when he touched them. Because there's almost this bond that forms if it's a positive. But regardless, for both of them, if someone's not comfortable and they were touched, it looks like they spent less and they spent less time in the store. And we also asked whether they would return to the store in the future because one of the things that people kept telling us is, yes, I'll buy, but I'll never come back. So we do have that measured. And preliminarily, it looks like we also got the effect that we would expect. If you're not comfortable, you're not coming back anytime soon. So that just goes against a lot of what's out there where people are always telling us that, oh, no, it's great. And we're saying, no, not really.
So if you touch someone who is low touch, they might never come back to your store.
Exactly. And I actually have another example. We did a study with the campus tours on campus here. So they have 100-minute walking tours for parents, and usually it's prospective students. And they were great. So they let us come in and have touch and no-touch tours. And so generally what they have is one person leading the tour, and it's 100 minutes because the campus is so big, it takes 100 minutes to go through it. They let us train the tour guides. So we had touch and no-touch where they put someone else, a second guide, on the back. And in the touch condition, the second person would have to touch every single person on the tour at least once during the 100-minute walking tour. And in the no touch, the person in the back would have to talk to every single person, because we didn't want it just to be that they got more attention. So people love these tour guides. These tour guides are incredible undergrads. They're great at what they do. On a 7-point scale, it's 6-point something in how much people love them. But we still found we got the effect that we expected. So people that are not comfortable with touch, they still like these guys, but they were significantly less likely to really feel as strongly if they were touched, if they were uncomfortable with touch. So even though we have this huge effect of everybody loving these guys, we still got this negative effect if they weren't comfortable.
Well, how about this? And this would apply to a lot of marketing, too. What if instead of talking to these people, the non-touch person had given each of them a little note?
Oh, yeah, that would be interesting. So it's like one step removed.
That's right. But, I mean, for example, if you want me to contribute to the Arboretum or something and you send me a nickel.
Right.
Am I not more likely to feel some kind of bond with you, whether I'm a touch or no-touch person?
So that's the norm of reciprocity, which actually is...
That's what they call it.
Yes, so that's... You're the norm of reciprocity. No, but that's a really effective persuasion technique, so people feel obligated. But I think I like your idea of a touch once removed. So it's sort of, you're both touching the same thing,
right,
but you're not touching each other. And what type of effect that would be? I haven't done that, but I think it might be interesting to pursue that.
What fascinates you most about this whole area of touch? What have you learned that surprised you or changed you kind of in your own life and way of seeing things?
You know, I think I'm not really a high-touch person, and I would not have thought of this if people hadn't said, I would never buy online because I can't touch. But I think the most amazing thing to me is right when I think that there's no more to look at, there's more to look at. So I thought it was just product touch information. Then it's product touch without information, just sensory that matters. And then there's the whole interpersonal touch area. So I keep hearing of more incidents where touch seems to matter that I would love to look at. So like insincere touch.
Insincere touch. Back to those politicians.
You mean calculated,
right?
I'm going to touch you because I want something?
Yes. Or talking to a law school professor, when you defend a criminal, you should always touch that criminal, showing that they're not so repulsive that you will actually touch them. And then I thought, well, what if you're not sincere in that touch? Can other people read that? Can the person who you're touching, can they feel that? So I think it's pretty interesting area to look at. And for negotiations, for sales, I think it has a lot of implications.
I'm kind of reminded of the Untouchables, you know, speaking of caste and class.
Right. Well, the other thing that's interesting is the idea of arts and crafts. So crafts are hands-on, and art is more removed. So the actual hands-on sometimes has sort of a negative connotation, whereas art is untouchable, it's removed, it's sort of on this pedestal. So I think that's just interesting, too.
An artist versus a craftsman.
Exactly. You know, how people use it.
Interesting. So, it may change how we do museums, too, if we start thinking about where do people who want to look at wonderful art, how can they somehow feel a connection without ruining the artwork?
Right. Just experiencing. And there are some sculptures where they encourage you to touch sculptures in museums. But I think people... So some people say people are touch deprived now because there's so much that's online, you don't get the same amount that you used to. And others say, well, that's fine. You can compensate it. You're used to that, so it's not a problem. I think it's a little of both. I think we kind of crave these sensory experiences, and I think that people are realizing that more.
That is kind of funny when you think about the museums and the fact that, you know, an art museum, the last thing you can do is touch anything. But then if you go out into one of the out of the galleries into a more common area, and let's say there's a bronze bust of somebody, the nose is totally rubbed smooth. You know, it's like everybody is kind of like catching up.
You see that a lot with sculptures. That's a really good point. People just can't help it.
Well, our guest this hour has been Joanne Peck. It's been fascinating. We can't wait to hear more about your research, so keep in touch.
Thank you very much.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.